We have got a lot to talk about today. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
I guess it's a good thing it's a Saturday then, since we have things to talk about.
Yeah, I think so, isn't it? Well, you know, Chuck, you know, we talk a lot about politics and politicians and what's going on in that zone, and I don't want our listening audience to think that we get into a rut. It's because those things are very immediate and very important, oftentimes, that we need to talk about them. And honestly, if you think about it, outside of our own choices that we make individually in our families, nothing affects us more than the decisions of a government. If government decides tomorrow that everybody's going to have to pay 25% more in taxes and they pass it, guess what? We have to figure out how to cut 25% of our living out. If they say tomorrow that you can't homeschool your kids, well, we got a couple of options. Either we go underground or we submit and we hand our kids over. So what we want to try to do, and what we're going to do a little bit today, is talk about some of these things that are happening in our culture and why it's because a result of government interference, unconstitutional, mind you, government interference, that the situation is as it is. Now, we're not just talking about politics, but we're talking about bread and butter, mom and pop, everyday choices that we have to make individually and our families for our children. And Chuck, there's really nothing much more common to the American experience that affects us all than buying a car.
I would say that's true. Everybody does it. When I say everybody, unless you're blind or completely disabled or have some other anomaly, the chances are you're going to buy at least one car in your lifetime, and I've bought a heck of a lot more than one.
Well, you know, and that's the whole point, too. And obviously you, with children of a majority age now, know about having to buy cars when your kids want a driver's license and they get a job, and or they're out doing things, or maybe they're going to college. When you get a family, like say you start off and oh, it's husband and wife and everything's all great and each of you have your own car, but then you have a baby come along and it's like, well, this car's not big enough, or this one doesn't meet our needs, so now it's time for the minivan. Or the American experience is that automobiles are an integral part of just about every family's life in America.
You just described how my wife and I went from a Datsun 200 SX to a Ford Aerostar, the big one, with the extended cargo area. Yeah.
Well, you know, and you get that. And of course, as his baby started growing, and all of a sudden that back seat that fits so well for a booster seat and a baby carrier and a toddler, all of a sudden for young teenagers, hey, you're pushing me. Oh, you're in my space. Hey, get your hand out of there. Oh, your elbow's in my ribs. And then we start realizing, well, maybe we need a bigger vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe we need one with more seating. Or maybe, as those kids get to that age, we need to get little Junior or little Janie their own car so that they can have some independence. But you know what, Chuck? That's part of the American dream. It's part of the American experience. But how many people do you know in your network of friends who can legitimately afford the payments on a new vehicle? I mean, a brand new, off the lot, brand spanking new with whatever, you know, and I'm not talking a stripped down car. I'm talking a comfortable vehicle, brand new off of a new car lot. How many folks do you think, without going into massive consumer debt, can make the payments on a new vehicle?
Almost nobody.
Well, you know, you run in a little higher tone crowd than I do, because I don't think of anybody I know of who can afford to pay that.
Well, considering the fact that at the current interest rate and the cost of a new car, if you put no money down or very little money down, it's going to cost you $500 a month to make a car payment. When a lot of people, their mortgage payments, if you think about it this way, mortgage payments before the escrows.
Yes.
Are maybe $800, $750.
Or more.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, let's say it's somewhere between $750 and $1,000 a month.
Yeah, virtually nobody.
And
in fact, I can tell you, I haven't paid more than $10,000 for a car in decades. The last car I bought that was brand new, trying to think if we have bought, no, the last thing I bought was in 1990. My wife was about 5 months pregnant, and we bought that Aerostar that I mentioned.
That's it.
And it was about $17,500.
Even then, it was pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Well, Chuck, according to research done by TrueCar.com, and as reported through Yahoo Finance, but it's through CNBC, and no, we're not endorsing CNBC, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get that out of the way first. In a article by Paul Eisenstein titled New Cars Increasingly Out of Reach for Many Americans, the typical new vehicle averages $30,500 in 2012. Now, you know, Chuck, as we were talking about this off air, as I'm driving up here to the studio, I'm seeing, you know, you go past these car lots, and of course, sometimes they have to go out and fill them up with gas in order to get somebody to take a test drive. Well, I saw this lovely, probably not brand new, but, you know, it was in the last 2 or 3 years, big Ford F-250 extended cab pickup truck. And, of course, in my neck of the woods, pickups are pretty popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were proud about how great a rate they had on this vehicle, $33,895. Now, Chuck, as I mentioned to you off air, unless you can prove to me that that vehicle is going to help you in a business recoup about $40,000 in cost savings or in greater productivity, that's a bad deal.
That's a real bad deal.
Because what is an automobile if not, in many cases, a money pit?
Well, unless you buy a really good model, and I've had really, I will say, good luck. There is no such thing as luck, obviously. We've been blessed with very good cars. The last car I bought was 5 years old, had about 80,000 miles on it, and we considered it a good find. Now, we've had issues. We've got a certain issue with it. You know, you're going to run into that. The car I bought before that was about 6 years old, and again, both of them under $10,000, and we considered ourselves very blessed to find both those cars. They've been relatively problem-free, but they still have to have maintenance. You've got things that go bad. Things that go wrong, and you've got to replace them, brakes and all kinds of stuff. So you got to count on your car payment plus a maintenance fee every month to keep that car running.
That's right.
Until the wheels fall off. Now, I will say, I do have a 1994 Mercury Sable wagon that's actually older than my youngest daughter. And it still runs, and my middle daughter drives it to work every day, and it's got... It's little pieces fall off it every once in a while.
And if you just nurse it for another 6 years, you can put historical plates on it.
There you go. Nonetheless, we keep it running by doing regular maintenance and that kind of thing. But it costs you because every 3,500, 4,000 miles, oil change.
Sure.
Belts, hoses, brakes, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Chuck, you know, I'm not nearly as blessed financially as you are, I don't think, because here are the ages of my vehicles. 9, 11, and 13 years old. Two of the three of them are sitting parked because they have various mechanical issues that I still have to get fixed. One of them is the one that actually is motoring around in, is closing in on 200,000 miles quickly. Now, my favorite one's closing in on 300,000 miles.
Yeah.
But I have to replace all the seals in it. So everybody just feel pity for me, all the guys out there. Because you know exactly how much expense I'm getting into here shortly.
But you have the greatest mechanic in the world, apparently.
I do. I tell you what, I love my mechanic. And if he can't fix it, he knows other guys who can and can do it fairly economically. But the point is, the vast majority of people, Chuck, don't have that as a luxury. They don't have the greatest mechanic in the world who charges them next to nothing. They don't have the ability, if they have a used vehicle, when something goes wrong, to be able to transfer money in their budget over to get the car fixed to keep it running without having to make some serious trade-offs. Whether that means that, well, that means we're going to have to stop music lessons for the little kids, or that means that, well, you know, honey, I'm going to have to work a few more hours, or I'm going to have to pick up a second job, or, you know, sweetie, you know, that repair that we need to do on the house, we're just going to have to hold off on because we got to have the car so I can get to work. Those are the trade-offs that most people have to make. Now, if you're talking about a brand new car, average ticket price of $30,500,
yep,
which means, let's be honest about it, Chuck, that $500 payment level was, that's low. You're talking probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $650 to $700 if you don't put down 20%. Now, if you figure that, that's $6,100 you'd have to have in hand in cash in order to put down on that car in order to keep the payments around $500
a month. Yep.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, why are cars that expensive? Now, is it because that we've got few competitors in the market and these big auto companies are just running a monopoly? No. I mean, think about it. Look at all the foreign models that we have out there, from Honda to Toyota to Nissan to Kia. There are so many choices in America for our automotive preferences that it isn't the idea that there aren't enough car manufacturers in the market. But what is it? What are some of the factors?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because to this actual article this morning, before you and I decided to do this, I wrote a reply on Yahoo.com, and I asked that question. Why is this? Why is it that people can't afford to buy new cars? And I put it together very quickly, in a sort of the way that I approach a lot of problems with things in government and private sector and how they interact. This is one of the places, the cost of cars and who can afford them and who can't, in which the interference of the government in the market makes the problem stand out in a bold relief if you look at it carefully.
Oh, absolutely.
So what I did was I thought about it for a minute and I said, okay, I wanted to ask the question because I always do Socratic method, which is, you know, I ask a question, then I see if somebody can answer it. Well, I didn't expect somebody, you know, I was in a conversation, so I answered it for him. And I said, why is this? Government regulation is a huge percentage of the price of cars. They meddle in labor costs.
Yes.
Ridiculous and unsustainable pension requirements.
Yes, that has to be factored in.
Quote unquote safety regulation.
Yes, CAFE standards.
CAFE standards, quote unquote environmental regulation, some of which create more environmental problems than they actually solve. Design consideration, mileage requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Which require more and more plastic and composite be used and less steel, which requires that more and more very expensive safety equipment be used to make up the difference.
Absolutely. Let's also not forget about the protectionist impulse of a legislator who might happen to have a auto production plant in his district, or say Honda in Marysville or the Jeep plant in Toledo or GM in Lordstown. I go on and on and on about how they might be interested in creating barriers to competition.
Yes.
Through tariffs and surcharges for vehicles being imported into the country.
Well, for instance, a lot of foreign manufacturers are getting around that by making reciprocal agreements with
American manufacturers.
For instance, I own a Ford Escape. And if you drive around with a Ford Escape, you notice cars with the same shape, because it's a little different than everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you know? A Mazda makes a model, and
right.
I can't remember what the name of it is.
I can't remember offhand either.
But it is a Ford Escape, because it's made in the same plant.
Sure.
The only thing different is a slightly different headlight, I think, and a slightly different rear window configuration. But otherwise, it's a Ford Escape. And they did the same thing with the Mazda 626, which was a Ford Probe.
Exactly.
Now, there are other companies that are building cars, have chosen to build cars. Where do they build them? They build them in right-to-work states.
That's right. Why is that?
Yeah. Why is that? Because they can get around some of the unbelievably onerous regulation that goes along with having a union in their plant. Does that mean they're going to be able necessarily to keep all their members from joining a union? No, but it does mean, for instance, Honda has managed to avoid that problem by keeping their workers happy and having them always vote no
on unionizing,
on attempting to organize.
Well, and of course, you know, we talk about, you know, minimum mileage standards, safety standards, putting in all these safety requirements, federal emissions regulations, all of those things, Chuck, all kind of blend together. But I think it's interesting because as part of this article, they looked at a study by Interest.com, the 2013 car affordability study. Now, you think with all of this Washington regulation driving up the price of a car, of 25 different major cities in the United States, can you name to me, or can our audience name to me right off the top of their head, the only city in the entire country whose median income can afford, without making sacrifices, the cost of the median cost of a new car? Washington, D.C.
Isn't that ironic?
What a shock.
Well, it's very ironic if you think about it. And what's the maximum monthly payment?
Well, right now, they're basically saying now the median income in Washington, D.C. is $86,680 a year. Okay. When you got members of Congress and K Street lobbyists living there, that drives up the median income quite a bit.
Which also tells you, because poverty is a real problem in D.C.
Yes, it is.
That means that the wealth is concentrated in a very small number of hands.
Well, yes, it would be.
So what we're getting into with this study, remember the three kinds of lies, white mm-hmm. lies, black lies, and statistics. This is one of those statistical lies.
Statistical lie, that's right.
Well, so if you live in D.C., you should be making $87,000 a year, right?
Well, the median income is that. Now, that doesn't talk about the mean or the average or the overall spread of the income.
That's right.
You know, on the top end, you've got guys making multi-million dollars a year. On the bottom end, you got people who are below the federal poverty level.
Exactly.
So not every family can afford that. Now, they looked at, like I said, 25 different major U.S. cities, including Washington, San Francisco, Boston, Baltimore, Minneapolis, Phoenix, and on, even Detroit.
Yeah, even Detroit.
Now, ladies and when you think about Detroit, Michigan, you don't think about wealth now, do you? Because we hear about all the blight and all the crime and everything that's going on bad in Detroit. Well, in Detroit, the average, now funny, Chuck, how they went from the median income in Washington, D.C. to the average income in Detroit. The average household income in Detroit is $48,968. Really? Really? The car that they could afford to buy, the maximum cost on that car is $17,093. And their maximum monthly payment is only $332 a month that they could afford as the average. Now, it's interesting because here's where they mix it up. It's weird because if you look in the article, it talks about the median income of $86,680, but then below they say the average income is $86,680.
Those aren't the same thing.
Those aren't the same thing, and you cannot have those two work together. Like
it can happen. You can have a coincidental median and mean, or a median and average. But what it means is that it's a well-distributed bell curve.
Right.
And I don't think so.
No.
That ain't the way it works in D.C. You have extreme wealth, extreme poverty. So I don't think this is correct.
Well,
somebody who doesn't know anything about statistics wrote this article.
Oh, absolutely. Well, basically saying that the bottom of the 25 major cities is Tampa, Florida, where the average income is $43,832, but they could only afford a car that's about $14,500 and making a maximum monthly payment of $282. Well, you know, that's all fine and well, Chuck, but, you know, one of the things that we forgot to factor in on the reason why the cost of new cars is so expensive is a little something that you were talking about to me offline earlier, and it was another government program. It was called Cash for Clunkers.
Cash for Clunkers. Well, let me finish my reply, and then because there's a couple of points in here that I did make. Basically, the mileage requirements and the safety requirements, but all this adds huge margins to the cost of the cars. And why can't you buy a decently priced used car? And if you've searched for a used car lately, they're very, very expensive.
Yes, they are. And if you get one that's not expensive, it's usually going to cost you a lot after the fact.
Now, think about this for a minute. Why can't you buy a decently priced used car?
Well, because it's supply and demand, Chuck.
It's
basic economics. The supply has been curtailed with Cash for Clunkers. All of these people were trading in the cars to get this free money from the government, and all of those cars, which could have been used for buying for that teenager who's just first learning to drive, etc., are now out of the stream. The demand's still there, but the supply went down because they turned those cars into metal cubes with compactors. That also drove up the cost of parts for your other used vehicles, because Where was the best place, if you had that 94 station,
Mercury station wagon,
where's the best place to get a used part for it? Would be at a
junkyard
that has a 94 Sable of your make and vintage that you could unbolt a condenser or an alternator or whatever it might be off of it, buy it for scrap, and then put it on your car.
Yeah.
Oh, well, wait a minute. But if it's been put through a compactor, it's not going to work very well on your vehicle
useless.
Anymore.
Yeah. It's a little bit useless. Now, there's another factor. And that is the fact that no one can afford to buy a new car. When people can't afford to buy a new car, it isn't sold.
That's right.
And therefore, you don't have a used one.
That's exactly right.
So I basically put in this formula. Scarcity plus demand equals expense.
Yes, that's right.
And bingo. There's why you can't buy a decent used car. And cash for clunkers is a big player in that because people were forced to go outside their budgets and buy up all the used cars because they couldn't afford a clunker. But normally, yeah, they would drive around. You know, everybody makes fun of them, the old junkers with pieces hanging off that are dragging on the ground and that kind of thing. But it gets people to work who can't afford a new car.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, I work with a lot of organizations that deal with people who are very low income. One of the biggest hurdles to being successful is being able to not get a job, but to be able to get to that job reliably and stay on the job. But if you have a car that breaks down all the time and you have to call into work, oh, sorry, the car broke down again, pretty soon you don't have a job.
No, pretty soon. That's right.
And if you don't have a job, then you don't have any resources in order to fix the car, in order to stay on the job. And if you look at it and say, well, go to your mechanic, well, you know, to fix that little wing dinger there, it's going to be, well, we can get a part for it, but it's $350. And then it's $100 an hour for labor charges. Well, you know, if you're looking at $600 or $700 to fix a part, to get a car to go back and forth to work, but you're looking at it and thinking, well, I don't have any savings, and, you know, we're living paycheck to paycheck, and funny thing is, my paycheck's only about $400 every 2 weeks. What do you do?
Yeah.
You're stuck. But if you could turn around and go and find one of those no longer existing, older, clean, used cars that before Cash for Clunkers might have been going for maybe $1,500, which you could make payments of $50 a month in order to get done at a used car lot. Now you're looking, and the lowest figure you're seeing is $3,500, $4,000, $5,000 for a used vehicle that may be 6, 8, 9 years old. But because there aren't that many of them out there, because everybody cashed in, well, guess what? Guess who gets hurt in that?
Yeah. Joe, slightly below average, who needs a cheap car.
Yep.
And let me tell you something. I don't have any statistical data on this, but I'm hearing more and more, and I'm seeing more and more little car companies that sat on the corner, buy here, finance here.
Sure. There's still some of those around.
There's still some around, but they're sinking fast.
And I know what I've been seeing is the trend is you really can't find anything older than about 4 or 5 years old on most of those lots.
Yeah.
Because it's just not out there. Because number one, the people who have them are trying to hold on to them because it's cheaper to do the maintenance on a car you don't have a payment on than it is to make a payment and then still have to do maintenance.
Well, for instance, my 94 Sable I bought used, and it's been paid for 11 years.
Yeah, there you go.
And my Ford Escape that I bought several years ago has been paid for almost 2 years. And, you know, the way I look at it is, every month it runs that I don't have to put money into it, I saved $235 on a car payment that I was making on that car, and I don't have to make on another one.
Yeah, well, you know, and the other sad part about this is, Chuck, you know, if you take a look at this whole situation, ultimately, an automobile is not a durable good, honestly.
No.
It is a consumer good because the average lifespan of a car in America now is probably about 7 to 8 years of reliable service before you have to start putting major money into it, whether it be for engine repairs or transmission or electrical system or the computer or whatever else goes wrong in a car over time and wear. But the fact is that at $32,000 for the average price of a new car.
That's right.
You start running the numbers on that for consumer good that you're going to end up either putting a lot of money into later or trying to trade off. that's really not a wise investment decision for a family, even if you need the car, is to buy a brand new one anymore. I mean, you think about it, you're saddling yourself with a lot of consumer debt that you're never going to recoup. Because think about it. Now, my father sold cars for a living.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we hear today, oh, well, you know, you drive a brand new car off the lot, you lose about 25% of the value immediately driving it off the lot. That's not really true. You lose 60% of the value.
Mm-hmm.
you take that car back in to resell it or to trade it in. If you paid $30,000, if you think they're going to pay you $20,000 to get it back or $24,000 to get it back, you have forgotten a basic rule of economics. They are not going to put more into the car than they can make in profit.
That's right.
It just doesn't happen. When you drive back and you go to sell that car a couple of years later or 3 or 4 years later with its 80,000 miles on it, like that one you were talking about, that five-year-old car, you're not going to get 20-some thousand dollars as a trade-in. You're lucky if you're going to get 10, because they're going to have to put it out there at 20-some thousand dollars. Because originally it was a $33,000 car. But in order for them to make their money, and they have to pay, now that's the other thing we didn't talk about. On the car dealer side, they have to pay a thing called an inventory tax. And it depends upon what's called their floor plan. Now their floor plan is the number of cars and the price tags on those cars, or the value, base value of those cars that they have during tax time. They have to go around and do an inventory like every other business does, and then they have to pay a tax on their floor plan. Now, who do you think pays that tax?
Oh, yeah.
It's the ultimate consumer who has to pay that tax,
now,
which means those used cars, that's where they make that floor plan back. Because really, the new cars, the numbers are out there. Everybody knows what a new car costs. You can't have a dealership that has a new car of a certain variety priced 25% higher than their competitor in the next town. They're not going to sell any new cars.
Somebody's going to drive over there and buy the car over there.
Yes, they are, because people will move around in order to find deals. Where they're going to recoup that tax is in the sale of a used car. Because they can get them in low, sell them out higher, and then if they have to wiggle a little bit, they've got some room to come down on the price of those without running into any. Now, used to be that car manufacturers would give what's called dealer incentives to try to get those new cars sold. And we saw this during the during the last recessionary cycle here of about a year and a half, 2 years ago. All kinds of deals were going on out there. Buy now, we'll drop $5,000 off the price, et cetera. Well, what was happening is that was money that would have been rebated to the consumer, but the dealer flips it so that he'll take it off up front, and then he submits it to the manufacturer, who then pays him the money.
Well, every once in a while, you'll see a thing that says all rebates, blah, blah. It'll be in the
fine
print at the bottom.
All rebates,
blah, blah, blah. Incentives go back to the dealer. One thing about that inventory tax thing, I think Ohio eliminated that by going to the CAT tax.
Yes, but a tax by any other name
exactly.
hurts you just as
no,
much.
No, Barry, let's talk about this, because what we're talking about is government interference in the market and what it does. One thing that happened with the CAT tax, it eliminated the, and some people had advantage to that, and some people got really stung by the CAT tax. I got an advantage out of it because I was paying about $1,100 or $1,200 a year in inventory tax, and now I'm only paying about $250 a year in the CAT tax. But what people don't understand is grocery stores were exempt from the inventory tax.
Yep.
But when the CAT tax came in, they're now paying on their yearly gross, not net, gross, with an exemption for their first, certain amount. When you think about how much money a grocery store runs through and what their profit margins are, it's usually not very good. It's a really high volume, not very good. So what did that do to the average consumer? We got stuck because the state of Ohio suddenly decided that they needed to get revenue out of grocery stores they weren't getting before. And don't kid yourself, that's not what happened. And the same thing with car dealers. They have to have a certain margin to meet that CAT tax. So what did that do? That jacked the price of a used car. That limited your negotiating ability when you're negotiating on the price of a car. that limited your ability because they've got to make a certain margin to be able to cover that CAT tax.
That's true.
Which is generally much higher than the inventory tax they were paying. They're one of the things that got stung by the CAT means commercial activity tax. People who don't understand.
We're not taxing your pets.
Not your cat. Yeah.
That may be coming. But.
Well, I'm sure at some point, I don't know, if you've ever bought a dog license.
Yeah, well, that means the government owns your dog. But
yeah.
That's okay.
Well, or they would own him if, you know, you've got to pay us the ransom. We've kidnapped your dog. You have to come pay us the ransom to get him back. Prepay the ransom, and we promise not to steal your dog. But that's the bottom line here. It's government meddling in these things in order to do more quote-unquote good is never good. It's always bad.
Yeah, well, what was the old saying that Reagan said the most frightening words in the English language are? We're from the government, we're here to help.
Yeah, we're from the government, we're here to help you. Ah!
Yeah,
run screaming from the room. But the bottom line here is, ladies and gentlemen, cars aren't going to get any cheaper.
No, they're not. Not anytime soon.
And there's a constant, if you look at the regulations, there's a constant timetable that the screws are being tightened. By such and such a date, you have to meet this standard. By such and such a date, you have to meet this standard. By such and such a date, you have to meet this standard. And as they approach, everybody says, oh my gosh, what's this going to do to the cost of a car? Well, we're now seeing the fruits of that. Because the average car, and this is not a really super loaded out, really nice, super duper car.
Talking about a stripped down version, yes.
$30,500. Now you could buy a Kia Rio for about what, $17,000 or?
Yeah, and that's honestly, Chuck, I get personally offended when I start looking at new car prices. Let's say you take a mid-size car for your family. Remember when our grandparents, they liked driving the big cars.
Yeah.
The Lincolns and the Mercurys and the old Cadillacs and things. Do you realize that now if you drove something like that, whether it be, and we can say a Lexus or whatever, but let's talk, you know, even the domestics, the Mercury, you know, a large Mercury or whatever, or Lincoln Continental when they still made them, $45,000 to $50,000, Chuck, for a car. You can buy a home for that cost. Now, it wouldn't be in the best neighborhood in the world, and you'd have to do some fix-up, but you can buy real estate for that kind of money. Now, real estate is a durable good. It is a long-term investment strategy. It does have the likelihood of appreciating, and it is something that you have flexibility in the use of or the disposal of, unlike an automobile. But you know what? If somebody's sitting there making a decision, they decide, well, we're going to go ahead and get into debt up to our chins here for a $50,000 car. Well, you know what? That's just really, really – I'd really like to sit down with them and talk to them about their presuppositions in their worldview. Because to me, it's – even if you could quote-unquote afford it, why would you want to? Why would you want to spend it on a consumer good that is depreciating immediately after you take possession of it, who continues to depreciate for every mile you put on it, who then ends up with an increasing scale of costs involved with it for maintenance and repair, when you could be investing that money or even saving that money instead of paying $50,000? How about you buy a $15,000 used vehicle, pay it in cash? You don't have a payment. You're not paying interest on it. We haven't even factored in interest.
No, we haven't factored in interest.
We're not factoring in interest on any of this because that $50,000 car is going to be $62,500 once you get done making your 60 to 72 months worth of payments.
And that's what it takes. In order to make those payments, that $550 payment, I think that's a five-year loan.
That's a 60-month loan, yeah.
Yeah, a 60-month loan.
And now they're stretching out to 72 months, and I've even heard that you're talking about 84-month loans. By the time you get done paying the loan,
you've paid for it three times.
You've paid for it three times, and the car is not worth one-third of what its original cost
was. That's right.
Was.
Well, think about this. Now, I was predicting that this was going to happen in the 80s. Show you how long I've been thinking about this. I said, this is an unsustainable cost growth. And I remember sighing to myself about how it was going to cost $20,000 for a car in 1982 dollars.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that would have been a lot. Yeah, that's about what it is now. Yeah.
Because I bought a car. I had to buy a brand new car. I was in a car accident, and I had no choice. I had to buy a brand new car. And interest rate, by the way, was 18% in 1981 when I bought that car. And I think I paid about $10,000 for it. It was an Eagle. Remember the American Motors Eagle? There's a car manufacturer that isn't around anymore. Couldn't make the cut.
That's right.
Okay.
You know, it's interesting because you were talking about the tax rates. In Ohio, we are a little bit blessed because, and I'm taking this from the Ohio Department of Development, that especially for the automotive industry, the tax rate for automotive manufacturers and dealers in the state is less than everybody in all the surrounding states. And just about Wisconsin's just like a tenth of a percent higher than we are at 4.4% of taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that means that probably it's a little bit more economical in Ohio, maybe, but you still have to deal with all the federal regulations and all the fees, et cetera. And you're still dealing with the situation that if you buy a brand new car and you finance it, you are paying a lot of extra money for something that doesn't hold its value. Now, again, ladies and gentlemen, we need to be good stewards. God's word calls us to be good stewards. He also wants us to have blessings. But, you know, if we have to make that choice between a major car payment of $500, $600, $700 a month for 60, 72, 84 months, and buying a step down model, that's still nice, still clean, maybe a little more expensive than we'd like for the mileage and the year of the model, but we can do it without having a 60, 72, 84 month, mm-hmm. $600, $700, $800 payment a month, and we can pay for it in, say, 36 months at $300 a month, or we can just flat out pay for it in cash, trade in your old car, trade in cash, etc. The responsible stewardship is not to get in debt. And that's really where we're getting at here, Chuck. Ultimately, honestly, number one, it's unconstitutional for the federal government to be horning their nose into the automotive industry as they do, because it's a violation of the Constitution. Yes, they can help regulate commerce, but what they're trying to do is pick winners and losers. The bailout, stimulus plan, whatever, was saying that because the American automobile industry can't compete, we're going to go in and give them taxpayer dollars in order to subsidize them. Well, we're all seeing how that's working out as the cost of vehicles are going up, up, and up, and we're having more and more issues. You know, honestly, there are a lot of newer vehicles that are having major mechanical problems now.
Yes.
You used to be that the old argument was if you had a newer car and it came up with a major snafu, it was either manufactured on a Monday or a Friday, right?
Yes, that's right.
That's the old joke. Nowadays, it's not quite that way because, and then think about it, you go under the hood, where are we getting all the parts from? That part came from China. That part came from Mexico. These parts came from Japan. These parts came from Peru.
Yeah.
What happened to? Why? Because the federal government created those problems through muddying around and basically through our tax structure, through government regulation and interference on domestic producers. It's cheaper to bring it in from overseas. They don't have to worry about EPA regulations in Guangdong, China. They don't have to worry about CAFE standards. Well, they kind of do. But they don't have to worry about CAFE standards for what they're producing in plants in Peru.
Yeah.
That's all government, and it's all unconstitutional. But a bigger issue, again, and this gets back to what we said on yesterday's program, we're responsible. The individual, the family, self-government, family government, we're responsible for being good stewards. Consumer debt, runaway consumer debt, I'm going to pause it, and I'm sure we're going to hear radios clicking off now as people turn us off. Runaway consumer debt is unbiblical.
Oh, absolutely.
The scriptures are clear. Every time they talk about debt, the word curse is connected to it. Debt's a curse. The borrower will be servant to the lender. Can't get more clear than that. when somebody decides that they're going to go and basically mortgage the future to get their $50,000 car, they're in bondage. It's not just consumer debt, it's spiritual debt. We're called to a different standard by God's word. We're called to be good stewards. We're called to take every thought captive to Christ. What better can we do? I mean, and of course, you'll get the argument from people, well, buying that car keeps people employed and they pay taxes, etc. I get all that. But you know what? If you bought a car that was a lot less money or not a brand new one off the lot, they're still going to make cars. But we're also going to have make parts, etc. People are still going to get to be employed, but you and your family are going to have a much better option of not being in shackled to a large consumer debt. Possibly, and if you pay cash and you're good stewards, having more money to give to tithing agencies or to provide for your family, put away a nest egg, etc. I haven't seen too many people whose inheritance, other than those who collect classics, whose inheritance is the family car, and that has been valued at the price it was when it was bought brand new.
Or my middle daughter got my 94 Mercury Sable wagon.
Woohoo!
Which we always joke about. You know, she goes out and starts it up. Well, it's still running.
And to be grateful for that.
That's right.
And thankful to God for it. That's right.
So, bottom line here is that there is a law of unintended consequences, and we are now reaping the whirlwind, that the wind that was sown earlier by just going regulatorily hog wild. We now see things like automobiles that cost $30,500, with the median income in the United States being about $50,000 or maybe slightly under $50,000 a year.
Now, I think it's like somewhere around the $48,000 a year mark.
So basically, it requires an entire year, essentially about 67% of a year's salary to buy a car, a brand new car. And like I said, not a particularly luxurious car.
And you know what? And this gets back to my whole point about the cost of a house. If you've ever, and many of our audience might know these guys, Ron Blue, Larry Burkett, even Dave Ramsey, all of these guys that counsel people on their finances all say that even your house debt shouldn't be more than 2/3 of your take-home income. As a matter of fact, it shouldn't be more than 1/3.
Right.
Why in the world would you think that buying a car that's 2/3 of your annual income is a good idea? I mean, if you're not even supposed to do a mortgage and that's talking the mortgage, the insurance, the taxes, etc., all that combined shouldn't be more. Actually, no, I remember Burkett said it shouldn't be more than 25% of your income.
Wow. Are they talking about 25% of the payments being 25% of your income?
The payments being 25% of your income.
I was going to say, that's about where my house payment is.
Yeah. It shouldn't be any more than that. But we're talking about a consumer good, not a house that appreciates in value, on land that appreciates in value. We're talking about a consumer good that depreciates immediately after you take possession of it,
right,
who continues to depreciate, and who, even if you catch them on a good day, the trade-in value is not going to be very much.
No.
But you're going to be spending the ticket of this 2/3 of your annual income? Now, even if the payment, the payments are not 25% of my, even if your payments are $300 a month, you still have to weigh that off against, my house is only $800 a month, but I'm paying $300 a month for a car that I can't turn around and sell for more than what I paid for it.
That's right.
Now, I know the housing market's a little weird right now, but ultimately, most people are finding you can still sell your house for about what you've got into it, or maybe a little bit of appreciation.
Yeah. Well, and that being said, I think we've pretty much driven the nail through the coffin on this subject. I'm sure if you have anything that you'd like to say about it, please go to www.principledpolicy.com. And when we put this podcast up, which should be in the next day or two, leave us a comment. Listen to the show. Leave us a comment. If you think we're full of fertilizer, let us know that. If you think we're 100% right, we really like to hear that. And if you think we're somewhere in the middle, Well, fine. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, Chuck, you're right. We probably have kind of exhausted that, but there's a rider to this, because what we've got is, when we start doing all this consumer buying, what do we have to have? We have to have a better job. We have to make more money. Well, if you're in a union, we have to go out on strike in order to get higher wages. Well, there's an interesting article also in Yahoo Finance that was a writer attached to the one we just talked about, that talked from BusinessInsider.com, written by Mandy Woodruff, entitled "How a Family of Four Manages to Live Well on Just $14,000 per Year." Now, it's interesting here because they do say the median household income in the U.S. has dropped to just over $50,000. So your numbers are a little bit more correct than mine. And it says, well, basically, hey, try to support your whole family on $14,000 a year. Well, this family's doing it. It is Jason and Danielle Wagoski, who have, he's 31, she's 28, and they have two little kids, and they live in a three-bedroom home in Las Vegas, Nevada. Oh, well, that helps explain a little bit of it. Las Vegas, Nevada, which doesn't have income taxes.
Nevada is not an income tax state.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that they're not. I'll double check that.
I thought the only two were Tennessee and Florida.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, we'll figure that out.
Now we got something to look up for, so okay. We'll look that up. But the point is, this article is discussing how they are figuring out how to do this with $14,000. Now, he gets that from the GI Bill because he is a veteran of the service, and he's working to get his undergraduate degree. But his wife has a blog called Blissful and Domestic that she's put up there, and she basically talks about how it works. And the funny thing is, she references a book. And Chuck, I've met the family who wrote this book. Actually, I have copies of this book. It's called America's Cheapest Family Gets You Right on the Money. Now, it's an interesting book because the family that wrote this book, I met them at the homeschooling conference a couple of years ago. It's Steve Economides and his wife, Annette, who wrote this book. I would recommend this book for people, for all of our listening audience. And you can get it. I just went over to Amazon. You can get it for about $8. Okay, so it's really not all that expensive to get. But the point is that it basically shows you how to be frugal. And you're not like sitting there in a house that has no heat and no electricity and you're eating out of the dumpster. You know, forget that.
Yeah, that's not what we're talking about.
That's a Hollywood stereotype that doesn't work. But basically, she said, how can we do this? We need to scrape together $30,000 for a down payment on our home, so we decided to create a budget. Well, they created a budget, and she started to do certain things, like instead of eating out a lot, cooking at home. Well, you know, also, Chuck, and my wife has done this before with some of her friends, you have monthly gatherings with your friends where you buy up a bunch of raw materials, and you have cooking parties, and you cook ahead, and you freeze stuff in your freezer, complete meals. That way, if you get the urge to have a splurge, you just go to the freezer and you pull out something and it's already pre-prepared.
There you go.
You just heat it up and you're ready to go. So if mom's tired or dad's been working late or the kids have had a rough day and nobody wants to be in the kitchen and washing dishes and everything else, you can just pop this in the microwave and go. But, you know, she went to thrift stores. She got a $7 bread maker, and I think you guys did something like that too.
We did something very similar, yeah.
You know, she goes to wholesale stores like Costco or Sam's Club, or hey, my favorite, and it's not a wholesale club, Aldi's.
Yeah, we shop at Aldi's a lot.
I you know what? And frankly, I hear people Aldi their stuff. So no, it's not.
It's delicious.
It's not. It's very good. As a matter of fact. But you know, she basically says you just got to learn to stay on a budget, and I mean stay on it. Discipline. Self-government.
Exactly.
And family government. Everything we talk about biblically applies to our family economy. And the Wagoskis have got it made. She does do it yourself. She makes her own soap. Now, not everybody's going to be able to do that, Chuck, but I do know a lot of families who do it. And you know what? When you get a network of families together, and I know you guys have networks too, barter is a beautiful thing.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Like one family's making soap and one family's raising chickens and getting hormone-free, no pesticide eggs, And another family over here, maybe they do woodworking and they can create furniture or chairs. And this family over here may do something else, and maybe the dad's a reloader, and so you can buy your ammunition.
Hey.
You can trade for those things. And I know I've got a lot of stuff from a lot of different quote-unquote family businesses in our home that we've traded, because one of our great barter items is sewing time, because my wife's a seamstress. It's beautiful. We've even traded for health care.
Sure.
You can do it. It just being willing to step out and do it.
The government, again, the law of unintended consequences, the government is stepping in and stopping things like my father used to do. My dad owned the local drugstore in Hebron, Ohio for years. And one thing he would do, every once in a while, he'd bring home a couple of times he brought home a dressed snapping turtle. Because
yes.
Somebody needed something at the drugstore.
There you go.
And I said, would you trade a butchered and dressed
turtle?
A snapping turtle. My dad said, oh, I've had turtle before, sure.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Yeah.
And he brought it home. My mom fried it up like chicken. And let me tell you, some people say it tastes like chicken. It's delicious.
Yeah, it is.
The snapping turtle was very, very tasty. He used to bring home things he brought home. I remember once he thought he was getting a dressed duck, and he got a live duck.
Oh, boy. So did you learn how to dress a duck,
no,
Jack?
No. We learned how to take care of a pet duck. But he'd bring home chickens and all kinds of stuff. He would barter all the time. He bartered for all kinds of things. So he was a federal firearms license dealer at one time, and he traded guns for
Absolutely. Now, Chuck, just so our listeners don't think that they have to go and be Jed Clampett or anything, or go back to the Stone Age, which that's great. I love it. That's the way we live. I like that kind of thing. But the Wigoskis here in this article, they're not doing really without. It says here one of the ways they save money is they traded cable for Netflix and Hulu.
Oh, yeah.
So they're paying for a monthly download. Well, $14.99, they're doing the big package. But to think about it, they're living on $14,000 a year. They can still do Netflix and Hulu.
Yep.
They don't do cable, because why pay $80 for channels you're not watching or more a month? And they do, when they go to the grocery, she shops once a month, Chuck, at the grocery store. They have $400 a month that they budget for groceries. That's it.
Wow.
She pays cash. She goes, she stays on budget, she doesn't buy impulse
items. And she probably coupons.
Probably coupons, too, but they budget $400 a month, and when it's gone, it's gone. That's it. You know what? My wife loves the idea. It's called the envelope system.
Oh, yeah.
Where you get cash out, and you put it for various categories, whether it be groceries,
right,
or entertainment, or whatever it be, and that's it for the month. And when the envelope's empty,
there's
no more going out or doing this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
They do keep a credit card for emergencies, and I understand that.
We don't
even keep credit cards. I keep a debit card, which means I got to have the money in the account.
Well, you know, you can't buy a plane ticket or rent a hotel room anymore. You can pay cash for those things, but you got to guarantee them with a credit card.
Yeah.
When you make the res.
Now they, being in Las Vegas, and you know, I've been around Las Vegas before. It's an interesting town. You can, if you really are diligent about it, can walk to a lot of things you need to get to.
Yep.
They try to make it on one tank of gas per month. Now that's impossible for me. Okay.
I know that.
I'm not worthy on this one.
You're lucky to make it on one a day.
That's right. And honestly, that's exactly about what it is. It's about a tank a day. But the point is they combine errands and doing all they can to make a tank of gas last a month. It says, we know we don't get to drive and visit family often, so when we do it, we cherish it. We don't just go for an hour. We stay and visit and even run errands that may be close to where we have family. We try to remember that when the gas is gone,
it's gone.
They've paid for both of their cars in cash. I don't think they paid $30,800 for their car. Now, did they? Basically, they paid off his truck while he was earning more before he went back to school, etc., and when they could afford it, and they bought a van, and it wasn't a new van. They paid it off within a year. Now, that's frugality, Chad. That's a smart thing. Zero car payments. Now, if you remember, they're saving up $30,000 for a down payment on a house. You know what that does? That cuts down the length of your loan.
Oh, absolutely.
It cuts down the interest you're going to pay. It also means that you don't have to pay the points and you don't have to pay the insurance because you've paid more than 20% down. That's pretty smart thinking. If you can save all those fees and you can save the, instead of a 30-year note, taking on a 15 or a 10-year note, folks, you just have to sit down and do the calculations and the math yourself. But if you're disciplined and self-governed, there's no reason why any of us can't be very similar to this family. If they can do it on $14,000 a year, I'm sure we can do it on, well, what's the average median household income of $50,000 a year? You know, I'm actually kind of embarrassed. I thought we were doing pretty good in our family, but I can see that maybe it's time for a budget meeting.
Well, you know, I watched my brother do this too. My brother bought a house. In fact, he bought my parents' house for a very good price. He bought 7 acres and what amounts to an old, what they call a Palatinate style brick house, farmhouse from my parents. And he scrimped and saved and did sweat equity and, you know, cut corners on things and lived very frugally for about the first 4 or 5 years of his marriage. And sold the house for double what he paid for it by doing the sweat equity and fixing it up and getting this and that done. Then he bought a house. He used that money to buy another place that's really kind of spectacular. One of these days I'll take you up there and have a look at it.
Yeah, I've never been there. I'd love to.
And it's really a beautiful place. He's got 10 acres and a beautiful house that he, you know, they took a small mortgage and he paid it off early.
Yeah, well, there you
by
go.
By doing the same thing. Sweat equity.
Beautiful.
You know, doubling house payments.
Doubling the premium on the principal. Because you can do that if you direct it to the principal, they have to accept it and it knocks your interest rates down.
Exactly.
Or your amount of interest.
And I think he paid it off in 10 years. He took a 30-year mortgage, paid it off in 10 years or something.
Beautiful idea.
So now that's the kind of thing you can do if you budget yourself and budget your time and budget and do the things that you can do to cut those costs.
And if you get out from under debt, you're going to understand the meaning of freedom.
Oh, absolutely. And
because,
he does.
Because when you're free, because those disciplines will carry over once you get out of debt. And that's when wealth starts accumulating, Chuck. That's when inheritance starts accumulating. That is when family dreams can become realities. Because instead of pouring it away in interest payments to a bank or to a creditor, you're salting it away for your kids and their kids. The Wagoskis, they saved that $30,000 and then decided we don't like the idea of a mortgage. They went and took a look at foreclosures and found one that needed a kitchen replaced. They paid $28,000, and they fixed the kitchen with the extra $2,000 they had. They have a home free and clear, no debt. That's the way to do it.
That is the way to do it.
You know what? We all don't need to live in palaces. But the point is, we need to leave something for our children and our children's children. And if we don't leave them a legacy of freedom, liberty, and living within our means in order to give them the chance to live with better means. Well, Chuck, I don't know if the American experiment in liberty is over with or not.
And that's kind of the bottom line. How much, you know, since we're going to come back full circle to what we've been talking about for most of the week, this is what Joel McDermott's whole idea is behind restoring America one county at a time. Stop taking the cheese, because the cheese is more expensive than you think it is. It's costing you your liberty. It's costing you your freedom. It's costing you your family. It's costing you everything. And it's making you a slave. And he says, find ways to not take the cheese. In other words, don't take the advantage when it's offered to you.
Yes.
Do it the hard way.
Now, I took a look here on a listing. Just to close up, I wanted to clarify. I took a listing here, and this is based from the Tax Foundation. As of October 2009, Nevada does not have a state individual income tax.
Thank you.
Or corporate income taxes.
Thank you.
They make up all of their revenues from general sales taxes, property taxes, and licensing fees.
Which sales taxes is a fair tax because
yes, it is.
If you buy more expensive goods, you pay a bigger tax.
And they're one of only 4 states that do not have a state income
tax. I know
tax.
Florida, Tennessee. Who else?
Okay. It looks like Nevada, obviously. Washington State. Yep. Texas.
Okay.
Wyoming, I guess, as of this, does not have any. Or excuse me. I apologize. I looked at the wrong line. So, yes. Yeah, you're right. Now, Tennessee, I'm trying to find them here. Okay, you know what? We're probably out of time.
We are.
You know, Tennessee has a very little bit of individual income tax, supposedly. That's what they get.
Then they passed it because it was a big, ugly deal there for a while.
Yeah, and I think they passed it. So,
okay.
But Nevada, Washington State, Wyoming, and Texas look like the four states right now that do not have a state income tax.
I knew about Texas. Okay, well, that being said, we are out of time, as Barry mentioned. So we ask you to join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.